This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. And for someone who has a degree, it appears that Julius often speaks in metaphors when he attacks whites or Indians or...
Well, that's what happens.
People outside the country. And then as soon as he attacks journalists, he's speaking literally, and it's very dangerous.
That's what happens when you have these collection of degrees from the... From the social sciences. I use science very loosely there. And he's collecting a master's now. He'll collect his PhD. We're going to call him Dr. Malema eventually, I'm sure. No doubt. I think Dr. Malema sounds quite good for someone who wants to commit genocide. Well,
most intellectuals were the purveyors of genocide.
Mm.
Everyone in the Khmer Rouge, the top four, were students in Paris.
Yeah.
Where they learned Marxism.
Oh, and Robert Mugabe actually studied proper degrees in... at Oxford, I think.
Right. I mean, the only problem, Hitler didn't have a degree because he's like a failed artist, but they should have just given him one. Like today, he would have had one and wouldn't be such a genocidal maniac.
Well, he would have invented a grievance study degree, as we discussed with James on the last podcast, and easily got one of those. Something like how Jewishness pervades Germany as a... form of oppression or something to that effect.
Well, he wouldn't be wrong.
Ah, there you go with your latent anti-Semitism, Ramon. Yeah. All right. So carry on with Julius.
Right. And Kitty Amin is his name on the show.
Yes.
But I think it was important to talk about journalism because we have a reputation of not liking most journalists, which is largely true, by the way. But there are some that we do like. And I think one of them is in studio, Mr. Michael Apple from ENCA.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure of mine, especially on a bloody Monday morning, of all things.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. So, if you can have a distinction between what you do, are you an investigative journalist, and what, people who just write blogs that are published in the Sunday Times do, which is an opinion column, what are the fundamental differences, between those
two? We should probably be doing video for Mike's sort of grimaces every time Ramon says something really trolly.
So, look, let me speak for myself, what I do. And, it's fine and well to be called an investigative journalist. It's not a title that I have at ENCA. It's just something that I fell into on the basis of the fact that I don't like the hamster wheel of news. I don't like going to a press conference. Somebody spews out a load of rubbish. It gets regurgitated. Sometimes it gets challenged. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people giggle and chuckle when somebody spews hateful, racist bullshit. And other times, journalists will take that information and go, well, let's put it to the test. Let's see. So it's important to be in those press conferences and read the statements and so on. But the reality is that news happens on the ground, and that's where I like to be, in some far-flung, unknown place where I can stay away from the trolls and where I can just do the work on the ground. And the beauty of television is I can show people what's going on. It's not a unknown source, unnamed source somewhere on a telephone as a print journalist. The beauty of television is I can show what's going on. It's very difficult to rebut what I'm showing you.
This investigative journalism, as you're describing it, seems to be worlds apart from the news, as you mentioned, in terms of the 24-hour news cycle, the pressure in newsrooms that I'm told about by journalist friends to just produce stuff that gets clicks. The sense that if there's a story, you have to make it last as long as possible. So there's almost a forced hyperbole that happens in reporting. And with investigative journalism, as you're describing it, it's just the story. It's kind of old school journalism, what people would understand of go and find out exactly what took place and tell us, tell the people. Don't make more of it than it is, and don't try to create stories where they aren't.
And it's so easy for South Africans to lose sight of the fact that I was involved in the VBS report, the forensic report, a lot. And it's so easy to get lost in a couple of million to this guy, 100 million there,
yeah.
2 billion looted from the bank. But like significantly, what are the consequences of that? I also have a segment that I do on ENCA that also just kind of fell in my lap called It's Your Money, that we have to remind people that every single cent that is spent in government, it's your money, and there has to be a consequence for how it's spent. So that VBS report, just recently I took something out of that one of the district municipalities had spent conditional grant money. It's not just immoral, it's downright criminal what they did. And they invested it with VBS. So it's basic. I went and I said, well, let me look up. Okay, the streetlights are burning. They owe over 280 million rand to Eskom. Middle of the day, streetlights are burning. Just walk off the main road. There's always Kerkstraat. Every town has got Church Street. Just take, and which is generally where all the politicians kind of work and live and so on. Just take a 20-meter detour. There's raw sewage in the street. I could smell it before I could see it. And then I started asking questions. Like, guys, where's the contract for this? How long is this pile of rubbish that's taller than I am with used nappies and condoms? How long has it been here? 11 months. And the story just presents itself to you that this is the consequence. Why are South Africans not angrier about this? But this is where, and I've heard you speak about this, Jonathan, in the past, where you straddle the line between being an activist and being a journalist. And making a very clear distinction between those two. Or is it okay to be in that gray area where you see injustice and you decide, well, it's only me. There's no other media here. It's only me that's going to get this out. Does that make me an activist? I don't know. But I'm certainly getting the truth out.
Yeah. I mean, the activism journalism thing bothers me a lot. We've had people on the show before who have mentioned that the worry is that students who present to journalism school now are presenting because they see journalism as the best way to take something they already hold deeply as a cause and then amplify it and broadcast it to the public. And so that bothers me a lot. And I think that the problem with activism crossing over into journalism is there's too much incentive as an individual for you to try and overblow the story or report one side, not the other side more. Those types of things that happen. And then it's weird to me that journalists don't seem to see how this is the whole fake news phenomenon. This is how it happened. Because if you're an activist and you take your activism into journalism, you then report a story a certain way, because you're trying to make a point and you don't report the whole story. But people are not stupid. And because of the world being what it is now and the internet age, those facts will come out whether you report them or not. And then when you report them, what you do is people go, oh, well, what you reported is only half the story, i.e. fake news. And then you create activists on the other side as well. And this is the sort of dichotomy of that problem.
Yeah, if you cover all your bases, absolutely. Which in the world I'm in, you have to cover your bases because you're making some serious allegations against people. If you don't cover your bases, people are well within their rights to call you out on that. But I'm happy to say that I'm incredibly pedantic. I'm a control freak about my work. It makes me a bit of a nightmare to work with because I want certain things done in a particular way. Subs, if I feel the way I've said something, particularly because I wanted to get a particular side across and it's changed, then I go with my original because I was the person on the ground that saw it the way it was. So unless you're changing my grammar, then don't change it necessarily. But the other side, the giving room to people to come back at you, if you don't do your job as a journalist, you're giving them ammunition.
Yeah, quite. So as someone who doesn't like to stay in offices, tell us a little bit about where have you been? Where has your work, you know, taken you in the world or in South Africa? And how does that shape the way you see things? Because I think travel is vitally important. It's not just going to Saint-Tropez sipping cocktails, so that's quite fun. But it's actually about, there's a great show on Netflix. I can't remember the name, but the guy goes like to the worst places in the world. The Dark Tourist, I believe it's called. And he goes to Alexandria and Diepsloot. He was in one of them. And people are just having fun at a bar and doing donuts in the streets. And he's like, I don't feel unsafe. So he goes there and he says, it's bad, but you're not going to get killed because you're a tourist. So as someone who has traveled extensively, what are the stories that you can tell us that have impacted you quite a bit?
So where have I been? I've been to Zambia. I've been to Zim. I went to Kenya during the election violence. I was en route to Ethiopia to go to the African Heads of State Summit in Addis when there was all that election violence in Kenya, the various tribes chopping each other up. And so I got stuck in Kenya. But it's a great thing for a journalist to get stuck in a country where there's volatility and it sounds terrible, but it's...
Oh, that's what you need to do. That's what the reality. You need where you need to be.
So I was a print journalist at the time, and I wrote a story, The Wild West of Kenya. And I remember walking. The airport had been closed, and we'd walk to a particular corner of the street where the security at the hotel... We don't travel with security. We don't have that luxury. We're not BBC, Sky, CNN. When those guys were here for the Oscar Pistorius trial, they had armed security with them. It was a joke. Anyway, so the guy said, listen, I can half and half protect you up until this point. After this, you're in trouble. Had an AK stuck in my face. And I realized then that, you know, Michael, you're not playing journalism anymore. There's serious consequences for getting what's happening on the ground out. So left Kenya, went to Ethiopia, saw Muammar Gaddafi. Very cool. I had an old, stupid cell phone then that I still managed to grab a pic of the dude when he was walking with his all-female bodyguard unit. They're all dressed in this, like, naval type, light blue, dark blue.
It's the original Kanye.
Oh.
It was like a tunic, and unfortunately most of those girls were kidnapped and indoctrinated.
Yeah. And, I mean, it was phenomenal to just live through that. To see the last time I saw him alive. But from there, I mean, I've been to China twice. I've been in Hong Kong. I've been recently to South America. I was sent there specifically because South Africa is going down a particular route. So the idea behind sending me and a couple of other reporters, we were in... Argentina, we were in Brazil, I went into Venezuela. It was to look at what informed their policy decisions, how did it work out for them, and then to get that message across. Now, it's one thing to report from South Africa on what you read, but I mean, it's phenomenal to go there yourself and see it and chat to Venezuelans. And I went to the UN emergency shelters and I chatted to UN staff and I chatted to migrants. And what is it really like back in Venezuela? How the hell are you surviving? So travel for journalism is, you have to. Armchair journalism will get you nowhere.
And Jonathan, sorry. When you do travel like that, how can I put this in a way that makes it comprehensible? Because my thoughts are not very comprehensible at the best of times. Do you compare that with where you're from? Do you when you go to Brazil or Argentina or Kenya and you come back to South Africa, what do you think of this place?
Yeah, look, you it's only normal to equate your where you find yourself to where you come from. I'm the product of travel because my father was a diplomat for the South African government. He was in government for 33 years, old and new. He was one of the very few diplomats that was allowed to stay on after 1994. After his death, I found out a lot about what my father did. It wasn't strictly being a diplomat. He never ever spoke about it, but since his death, I've found out a little bit more, and it's important to find out who our parents are and what they do and the circumstances they find themselves in and how they justify it to themselves or they don't feel they need to justify it to anybody. So I spent time in the Middle East. I grew up in Bahrain. After I was born, my parents went to Switzerland. The anti-apartheid movement set off a bomb at the embassy. My father had been double parked purposefully, and as he walked back into the building, there was a petrol bomb that was supposed to go off, but they'd got the ratios wrong. So it just kind
of... Hated when that happens.
Just kind of... Well, I'd been born, so I was safe, but it just kind of fizzled, but a sign of the times. And my parents speaking about how difficult it was to be representatives of the apartheid government in the most neutral country in the world at that stage in the 80s, how difficult that was. Then my parents moved over to Germany. Then I found myself in the Transkei when it was still a homeland. And then my father was posted to the Middle East. So I appreciate that there are a lot more journalists and people that have traveled more extensively, but it certainly informed my worldview that people that have oogkleppe, that have blinkers on, you're only doing a disservice to yourself.
I absolutely agree with that, and that's why we try to discuss as much as we can on the show with as many varied people as
possible. From all over the world.
All right, you mentioned some stuff, and I don't want to skip over it. So South America, I think South America is interesting because you mentioned in there, there are some similarities. And I think that's absolutely correct. I know we like to look at the US, the UK, maybe some countries in Europe and perhaps Asia as well. And we say, well, that's where South Africa is kind of heading. I don't think we have the underlying structures of those countries. I think we have the underlying structures of the South American countries more so. And certainly in terms of policy, Brazil seems like quite similar in many of the ways their government has gone for many years and what led to Bolsonaro now being elected. Certainly, if the ANC goes left enough and if the EFF manages to maintain any kind of control, not necessarily complete control, but some, Venezuela looks like a potential option. And then there's sort of Argentina in the middle, which is essentially a banking crisis that just dissolved their economy. So give us some sort of insight into the most interesting things from those countries and maybe stuff that you found that people either don't know or isn't true. So Venezuela, you know, there's a lot of rumor and truth to the stories that come out of there.
So before I went over to Venezuela, I did what anybody would do. I went on Google, I Googled, I went on YouTube. John Oliver has a great insert that he did on Venezuela, and through humor he can show the outright terrible situation that's going on there. But then I saw a clip of a kid playing on a pile of money. So the Bolivar had they've just introduced the sovereign Bolivar, which is backed by cryptocurrency based on the value of oil. I got myself some sovereign Bolivar. And so I landed in Brazil, and I said, I'm going to fly to Boa Vista, which is the northernmost border with Venezuela. And people there were like, why? Why are you doing that? Sir, please take off your hat in the queue. Make sure you have no drugs under there. The Brazilians are quite hectic about that. But there's a lot of hype about what's going on in Venezuela. Not all that much interest. When I arrived at the border, the Brazilian military had set up permanent internment camps that they were processing 700 people a day. So roughly, the estimates are so varied, but it's up to 2 million people. if too many people are leaving your country for greener pastures, there's something wrong.
Especially when those greener pastures are Brazil.
Mean,
it's not like...
Well, they're fleeing into Colombia, for goodness sake.
Right.
So then you know there's seriously something wrong. But what I found strange was when I was speaking to people in the UN camps, these are people that had done, they had crossed over the border. It's a 200-kilometer walk to Boa Vista, which is a stronghold of Jair Bolsonaro. It's basically just a big military base. And him being a former captain in the army, it's a big... So they don't like foreigners there. They don't like gays. They don't like blacks. They don't like journalists. So the amount of contentment and just relief from the Venezuelan migrants that I spoke to in these camps, they have nothing. They took the clothes on their back. They have no currency. It's worthless. And just to see how these people are so happy to just get vaccinations, because most of their kids have got measles. There's measles outbreaks all over the place, to just get food and to get water and a place to take a dump that's decent. That's it. And how these people are so happy, and you know, you think to yourself, geez, you know, we moan when in Bryanston the lights are off for 2 days, and how these people are forced to live. The guy I spoke to said, I lived on $1 a month, and they've reverted to a bartering system.
Yeah,
that's how bad it's become. It was shocking, but so enlightening. And I asked the guy, is socialism and expropriation without compensation? Everything was expropriated there. Everything was nationalized there. And he said the narco-communist regime of Nicolas Maduro has benefited, and then he tapped on his shoulder twice, denoting only those in the military. It's a very select few people that benefit from that system. And everybody I spoke to kind of gave the same account of it.
And these people, were you able to establish some of their backgrounds? So, you know, it's not people who were in poverty their whole lives, I assume. I assume there were qualified people, you know, people part of the middle class.
Yeah. Yeah, I spoke to a lawyer, a human rights lawyer. Unsurprisingly, he found himself drummed out of that country. I spoke to a personal trainer who, despite having lost 12 kilograms, they call it the Maduro diet.
Mm.
The Minister of Agriculture, they introduced bunnies to eat because it's good protein.
Yeah, and they reproduce quickly.
Exactly. Yeah, he was pissed off that they were keeping them as pets instead of eating them. But so this personal trainer said, look, it's not feasible to stay in a country where people are not, they're burning more calories than they're consuming. The population is slowly starving. And he said, well, I've lost 12 kgs, and it's just not a place to be able to live. Interestingly, I found a lady who, she works two jobs and then works weekends. She cleans people's houses. Her son is studying to be a doctor. He's remaining in Venezuela to finish off his studies. So somehow that entire system is so broken, yet for free, these guys are going to continue to study to be a doctor. It's just the disparity between what it was intended to do and the reality on the ground is just so vast.
Yeah, I worry about that intention versus consequence thing, because some consequences or some intentions can never, ever, ever work or exist. Communism can never be a stateless utopia. Never, ever, because you need someone to control everything and then give it away. And that is not in human nature. It's not in the interests of the Politburo. It's not in the interest of the army to give away everything to the proletariat. It'll never work. And it certainly did not work in Venezuela. Unfortunately, I suspect quite a few of those people that you might have interviewed probably sort of love Chavez.
Yeah.
I hope I'm wrong, but there's this thing that Maduro stuffed everything up. Chavez was the real hero.
Yeah, he had it going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's great while it lasts, and if it works for everybody.
And at $130 a barrel.
It worked for everybody. Problem was he wasn't putting any money away in a rainy day fund.
But it was a VBS bank on a much larger scale.
Exactly.
But that's all it is. But you can't centralize all the money and property and expertise and enterprise and then expect that to carry on forever, because you need new innovation, you need new technology, you need new ideas. And the bureaucracy of the state is the antithesis of all of that. So it may last for Saudi Arabia, you know, has lasted 30 years, but not forever. That's why Dubai is building massive skyscrapers and financial services are flooding in there, because they know it doesn't last forever.
I mean, you place so much trust in one glorious leader to control everything and his cronies that surround him. It's not in human nature to share. That's why you have to teach kids to share.
It's also not in human nature to flatten everything. People rise above each other in various ways.
I want to be fitter than Jonathan. I run further in the gym. You naturally want to be better than somebody else. I want to read more books. It's part of who you are. To be told we're all equal and you must just accept that. It's a very difficult human nature to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Jordan Peterson has this competence hierarchy hypothesis, you know, where hierarchies are natural and they are in Western countries predominantly, it's a core of competency. So you're very good at what you do and therefore you'll be rewarded because people will flood to you to get that service or that good that you do. it's not based on race or some other weird stuff. It's just pure competence. And if you destroy all of that, well, you are equal, but you don't want to be equal in poverty and equal in despair, I'm afraid to say.
Tell us a bit about what's going on in Brazil, because I got into a short spat, as I do, on Twitter some time ago. Ramon just throwing his hands up in the air. And my problem is that Bolsonaro, this was before he was elected. The election had happened and it was going to go to runoff. And people were freaking out because it was pretty obvious he would win the runoff. And the news stories were, you know, the kind of news stories that I can spot immediately are a problem. So Bolsonaro is Brazil's Trump. So I know a headline like that is a problem just because that what they're doing is they're trying to demonize two things on the assumption that the other one is correct, which it may not be. But there's a lot of these kinds of stories about the guy. There is some evidence, certainly, of the guy saying things over years that you would kind of look at and go, that seems like a dodgy thing to say, or that's just outwardly racist, or that seems by Western definitions homophobic, or all of these things. But I think actions matter more than words. Words don't really scare me. As you might know, I'm a free speech absolutist pretty much, unless you're calling for outward violence. And I just felt that there was some of this background, but there was a whole bunch of other stuff that the guy had said and a whole bunch of other things that he wanted to do. I mean, something that hasn't been widely reported on is he has turned around and said he only wants to serve a single term because he doesn't believe in politicians staying in power. Now, we'll see if that actually transpires. I'd be more than happy if he just follows the standard sort of two-term rule. That's okay. This is part of the problem. There are negatives to every human being on the planet and positives. And a lot of journalism, certainly around politics, has become so partisan that Obama was a scandal-free presidency. Trump is just absolute disaster. Merkel is amazing. David Cameron, horrific. They unfortunately that's not true for any politician. Some of them do good stuff and bad stuff. So tell us about Brazil.
Let's not forget South Africa in that equation.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, South Africa it goes without saying.
Yeah. Okay, so Brazil. I mean, I knew very little about Jair Bolsonaro before I got there. I'd done a little bit of reading on the guy. He got stabbed just before I went to Brazil. And so I made a point of going onto the streets of Rio and taking a break from sipping cocktails on Copacabana Beach. We were staying right on the beach. It was phenomenal. I took my Speedo with. No, seriously, I took my Speedo.
I can't believe it. You have a physique to wear a Speedo, unlike myself.
And so I walked into the streets, and some very enterprising shopkeepers had started printing shirts of Bolsonaro as the Godfather, that iconic. And then there was this what looked like a knife and a stab wound. So you could wear Bolsonaro's stab wound on you. It was fantastic. And I said, so, I mean, he doesn't believe, this is what was reported about him, that women should earn the same as men, women have a place in the home, and so on. So I spoke to some women in particular, and I asked them what they think of this guy. And they're just like, this guy is an absolute hero. This guy is amazing. We are so sick and tired of the left telling us that everything they're doing for us is for our own good, and it's to the benefit of the broader population. And all they've been doing for years and years and years, I mean, the scale of corruption in Brazil is phenomenal. You have to take your hats off to the guys. They have done a sterling job there. And they are just so tired of corruption that they are willing to take anything. And I see it as there has been no alternative put up by any other political party. They are throwing their lot in with this guy who has made the right noises. Whether he's going to follow through, actions, as you say.
Yeah. And what are those actions?
Yeah, that is going to be the interesting part. There are a lot of worried people, especially from the PT, the Workers' Party, and a lot of lawyers. There was a movement on the day I flew out of Brazil. There was a not him march through the streets, and it was a massive turnout, and they don't want him, but the alternative candidate is such, I'm sorry, he was such a useless whelp that he was never going to be able to offer anything. I mean, the guy that he was modeling himself on was sitting behind bars currently, Lula da Silva. Lula, yeah. His campaign slogan was, "I am Lula. Haddad is Lula." And if you're running your entire campaign based on the fact that
you're a guy who's in prison,
your demigod is behind bars, it's not going to work.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the "Love Trumps Hates" slogan of Hillary. It's like, okay, using "Love Trump" in your slogans, it's not great by any means.
There's an interesting thing that I think happens. You were mentioning lawyers, for example, that are anti-Bolsonaro. The U.S. is no similar to lawyers who are anti-Trump. I think it's a much healthier form of government, the state of government. I don't think it needs to be as chaotic as it currently is worldwide. But what you have in America now, for example, probably what you're going to end up in Brazil, what we had in South Africa to some extent, is you have a government that does certain things, and then you have an opposing sort of fourth estate, you have an opposing sort of judiciary, you have an opposing civil society. And so that's your check and balance. The problem, I think, that's far healthier than a system where those other entities agree with the state. And so the push forward is unstoppable, essentially. And so we see the South African example would be the public protector. You had a public protector who was pushing against the state, against Jacob Zuma's government. And now we have a public protector who clearly is not going to push against the state really at all. And we see the effect of that.
Yeah, and without an effective opposition in that manner, you're creating a lot of effective opposition in non-governmental organizations like ALTA, AfriForum, Institute of Race Relations. These are the big oppositions to the state, not politicians and not political parties itself. But I mean, it would be lovely if we had a more concrete version of that, but it seems like to be a public intellectual here, you must say that Cyril will save us and must give him a proper mandate next year because, he hasn't had a chance to express radar compensation adequately. You know, it hasn't been tried before very well. So the thing is, even in Brazil, which is not well known for its constitutional democracy, it only existed since 1985, it seems to be already a bit more developed democratically than we are.
They have a very healthy judiciary that stands up a lot. And I mean, Operation Car Wash, which is the big anti-corruption drive, that was certain sectors of government working to take on the executive and doing so very successfully. Hundreds of people have been arrested for that. The level of freedom of press. Some journalists have been shot dead, and some are disappearing. Some are. So I asked a Bolsonaro supporter about some of the comments that Bolsonaro had made in the past. "You're not worth raping," is what he said to a female member of cabinet, their Congress. And that clip is up on YouTube. Anybody's welcome to go and see that. And I said, you know, what about his stance on women? And he said, "Look, the media is captured." And I said, "Oh, there goes that word."
everywhere.
So he says the media there is aligned to the left. Then I go and speak to the Workers' Party. And strangely enough, the media there is somehow managing to hold both sides to account for what they do and what they say.
Good.
And the left says, no, the media is controlled by the right. And that's exactly kind of where you want to be, where people believe you to be assigned to both sides, except you're criticizing both equally.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of where you want to be?
Well, absolutely. What do you make of this sort of reactivity? I think Brazil is a great model for South Africa. So they have 25 years of, longer actually, 30 years of sort of very left-wing progressive politics, which keeps doubling down. So they come in with policies. Those policies don't work. They make things worse, specifically the economy, and that's really what matters to most people and what affects most people. So then they double down with a new policy to fix that policy, to make it even better, and they keep doubling down and doubling down. And so eventually, everything's in a complete state of mess. But now, the ideology you sold the people to do that is obviously a left-wing progressive ideology. And now there comes this word, populism, right? Mm-hmm. So the backlash to that, the reaction to it, is to go in the opposite way. I worry about, I mean, I don't like the word populism because I think populism can apply to anything. Julius Malema is populist. Donald Trump, I would argue, is populist. They're completely different individuals, in my opinion, and they represent different things.
But you get different types of populism.
Absolutely.
If you watched, sorry to interrupt, Steve Bannon versus David Frum, the monk debate, very good. I think if you haven't watched it, watch it. Steve Bannon said, "Populism is here to stay. It depends on what type, the Bernie Sanders progressive type or the nationalistic Trump type." Like Brexit. Populist, right?
Yeah.
Malema populist. I would argue ANC extreme always has been populist. It hasn't changed at all, despite what anyone else says. So, talking about the press, and did you want to finish your point on Brazil?
Yeah, that was just about what you feel about this backlash.
So,
and if you think that's valid.
So, a double down on a policy that doesn't work. In the case of Brazil, their social welfare program was massive. And very successful for a time. But they were inflating numbers. They were using private funds to push it into government coffers. And that's eventually what they got, the president that got...
Rousseff. Yes. Dilma Rousseff.
Where they were doctoring the numbers, making the economy seem like it was doing a lot better than it was. And ultimately, that is kind of what people care about.
Steinhoffing the economy.
Yeah. If you don't double down on a policy that doesn't work, it's an admission that the policy perhaps doesn't work. And if you introduce a grain of doubt into an electorate's mind that whoever is governing you has got it wrong, then that just opens up for your opposition. So these guys will keep throwing mud at a wall until it sticks, hoping that it's going to stick. Eventually, the people that are looking at government throw the mud will go, well, this is stupid. This isn't working. And that's where it opens the door for people like Jair Bolsonaro to go, well, let's try shooting arrows. Maybe that's going to work. Problem is, the same people that have got so much hope, and there's 150 million people that vote in Brazil. Do you know that it's a crime? It's against the law not to vote in Brazil. If you're between the age of 18 and 70, you must vote. If you don't, you have to pay a fine to government. So if you don't want to be an active citizen, then you must pay up.
For it.
Ramon would be paying fines his whole life.
If they catch me. I just draw penises on the ballot papers. But talking about journalists, more generally, Michael, because I believe you are one. locally, so... Okay, let's just go back to VBS, the story that you have worked on before. And by the way, Jonathan, I left the studio last week, and I just drove past the VBS corporate park.
Oh, did you?
It's literally 2 kilometers down the road here.
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea. Well, so anyway.
Don't think much activity going on there.
It's quite a big building. I'm surprised for such a small mutual bank. So, Paulie van Wyk works for Daily Maverick. She wrote a piece about how funds from VBS found its way into the coffers of the EFF through various channels. She writes this piece. It's a good investigative piece. The evidence looks rock solid. And then I go to her timeline and I say, this is a good piece. I go to her timeline and she's there fighting with people about the piece, arguing that it's wrong for someone to... just try to discredit her by calling her race out or being a woman, and things like that. So, unfortunately, the story becomes about her versus the EFF rather than the EFF stealing money from VBS. The problem I find that if you can't de-link the story from the journalist, one day that journalist is going to fuck up. One day there's going to be a planted story. They're going to get facts wrong. Those mistakes happen, and they should happen, because that's how you learn, right? But the problem is, if you become a brand, a journalistic brand, your brand will suffer if you make a mistake, and all your previous stories will have
held a cloud up to the light.
Right? People will be more suspicious of you, like Wa Africa and Hofstadter from Sunday Times. Maybe they will find work somewhere as journalists, but not anywhere reputable. Now, we had Valdemar Pelser on here a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, and he talked about, journalists must stop trying to be brands. They must just do their work. What is your feeling on that? And I know some of your colleagues, Nicholas Bauer, who we would love to have here, likes to poke
fun.
Please
come on the show.
Come on, Nick.
He likes to be opinionated, and we like him for it. I mean, it's fun to joust with him, right? The problem is, where is the line, and should there be a line? And more importantly, should the journalist become part of the story or not at all, in your opinion?
Okay, so we are told that there are different styles of journalism. Sometimes it's important to place it in the mind of the viewer what is happening. We are told sometimes the journalist must be put into the story. Another pet hate of yours, I've heard. Sometimes I do believe there is a place for that. Recently, I'll use the sewage example. I don't know if it equals putting myself, but I mean, it's unavoidable that I'm standing next to. I've got a stream of raw sewage flowing past me on my right, and I've got a pile of rubbish that's been there for 11 months. The aroma was overpowering. And I said to camera, you're lucky you can't smell through your television.
Yeah.
But I can assure you that this is bad. Now, I don't know if that qualifies as putting myself in the story, but I think it's sometimes important to show that this is where we find ourselves. And so, in terms of being a brand, let's look at the two sides here. Brand means credibility. Would you rather buy SsangYong shoes or Nikes, however you prefer to? to pronounce it. So people go with, oh, well, that's trusted. It will go with those shoes, the Nikes, the Nikes. So much of what we're up against in the media landscape is credibility. Now, if you equate credibility to brand to Twitter followers, you got a problem. Some of the best journalists I know, old school journalists, are not even vaguely interested in social media.
Yeah.
It is a toxic cesspool. Am I saying that there's no space for it? No. It's a very useful platform for me. People, ultimately, I want people to see my story. I want to be able to tell people this is what's going on. If that makes me an activist, then I'll take that on the chin. But we put a lot of ourselves into what we do. The cameraman has to stand knee deep in shit. Like, it's important that what we have found out gets out to the public. Not everybody's watching TV. Not everybody's on DSTV. Social media has found a great way to disseminate that information. Of course, that creates this impression that you are a brand for, say, service delivery. And it's happened. After that story came out, I've had people from far-flung areas phoning me, "Hi, Mike, yeah, sorry, you don't know me, but we haven't had houses built here for the last 5 years. So, and I dealt with this yesterday. I said, okay, who's the local councillor there? No, this guy. I said, you realize that this is an elected official from within the community to serve on the council, to carry out your wishes. Yeah, but he's not doing his job. I said, okay. I said, there are 1,000 dysfunctional municipalities in this country. I happened to pick up on one because VBS money had gone and it interlinked. But eventually, I'm going to find myself becoming a consumer watch journalist.
Yeah.
And as heartbreaking as it is for people in this day and age to not have houses and electricity for 5 years and to shit into a hole in the ground, which still happens, and to have water delivered by truck, whether the truck arrives or not, it's despicable. But it's very, very difficult to be everywhere at the same time. And that is where you have to withdraw yourself from a situation, in a sense where, am I going to be an activist for absolutely everybody's rights, or am I going to stick to finding the truth within the context of public interest?
Yeah. So I think that's fine, and I'm happy with that description. And I don't think you become an activist by reporting a story. I think you become an activist by deciding what stories you want to report and then finding them.
Mm. And you become an activist by standing in water and acting like there's a hurricane and there's two people walking behind you at a leisurely pace.
As if you're being blown away.
Yeah, even the TV lies sometimes, Mike, I'm afraid.
It's like we were discussing before the show. Jim Acosta is the icon of this problem that Ramon is describing. You know, love yourself like Jim Acosta loves Jim Acosta. And the issue really is as well as the credibility danger that Ramon describes, it seems as if, I mean, celebrity journalism seems to me to be exceptionally dangerous. And that's because, I suppose, with great power comes great responsibility. But at the same time, because it seems as if those celebrity journalists can lose sight of what their actual role is. So their role isn't to be celebrity journalists. Their role, like Jim Acosta has become, he's a joke. And it's widely thought that within that press pool in the White House, they all don't like him pretty much because of his grandstanding, because he's made it about him and not about anything else. And so I think there are really good, I mean, Pauly would be one. I think she would fit into the celebrity journalist category at the moment. And she's done good work. I can't fault her on that. But there's a danger. There's an inherent danger to that. And it bothers me, because before social media, I don't think we knew our journalists as well. And I don't think that was a bad thing. I think that we knew our newspapers, we knew our magazines, our publications, we knew our news channels. Yes, the anchor, you knew who the anchor was, and maybe, you know, you knew who Max Dupree was, and there were a couple. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a thing. And how did you become a great journalist? It wasn't by having a lot of Twitter followers, and it wasn't by being well-known or sworn at by the leader of the EFF. It was by just constantly producing great work that at the end of a 30-year career, you could say, this is what I did for the world, and this is how I made a difference. Most people don't know my name, but my work speaks for itself.
Yeah. You know, when the media is attacked, and attacked broadly, I can tell you it's human nature to want to defend yourself and to defend your profession or your particular media house. So I worked at ANN7, that was owned by the Guptas. It was attacked by Malema and said, we're not going to guarantee the safety of your reporters at our events. I've been on the receiving end of a lot of hateful stuff as a result of just having worked at ANN7 firstly, and then the leader of a political party kind of paints a target on your back. But, and now at ENCA, you know, I was at a press conference where he said that we had banned him while I was sitting there. And the best way to rebut something so ridiculous is to play his own words back to him and then an earlier live broadcast from me at the event. And strangely enough, I didn't get the trolls coming at me for that, because it's so obvious that it's complete rubbish what he's spewing there. But you inherently feel the need to defend yourself and to defend your colleagues. Polly, the amount of abuse that's coming her way, Ranjini's way, Max's way, Feriel Hafiji's way. Look, I agree with you. Let the work speak for itself. There's that lovely quote, the truth is a lion, set it free, it'll defend itself. It is very difficult. We are on social media. We're expected to be on social media. We're expected to tweet from events. It's part of what you sign up, your contract. You have a brand. You have a social media following. It helps the company. You are available to people 24/7 for nameless, faceless people to be able to say what they want to you, which it can really affect your psyche. I promise you, unless you make an active decision to switch off from that cesspool of people,
which is physiologically difficult to do because you're getting a dopamine hit every time you get a reply, even if it's nasty.
That is right, Doc.
Here's something I struggle with a bit. So Karen Morn had a very public feud with Batabile Dlamini a few months ago or a year ago or two. So
at
a
press, damn funny though.
It was at a press conference, and I thought Karen is doing her job. She's trying to get to the truth of the matter, and this minister is evading and obfuscating and doing all sorts of other things. Then, you know, it was. I found Karen to be a good journalist in that regard, in trying to get the question answered in the way that was truthful and honest. The problem is, then everyone says, oh, how good is Karen? And then Karen becomes like a bit of like a minor celebrity without intending to be so. And then we elevate these people for doing their job well to a place where, and with due respect, I think she's a great journalist, but to a place where perhaps it's not necessary.
We don't
say that an accountant is a celebrity because he cooks the books well.
The accountant was actually figured out the VBS stuff, because the truth is the journalists have reported on it, but there's a whole bunch of lawyers and accountants who have figured that stuff out and followed the trails.
Yeah. Look, receiving praise for doing your job. How desperate are we in South Africa for people that'll hold somebody to account? And I think when people go to a press conference, they read out a prepared statement, and then they say, all right, any questions? And you go, yeah, that's absolute rubbish what you just said there. And their unwillingness to actually be accountable to the people that put them there, that pay them the millions they earn. by virtue of asking the question, I asked Dr. Zweliem Kize, Cogta Minister, why are you not more outraged by the fact that 4.3 billion rand in municipal money went to... Where is the outrage from you? No, we're going to look at this. By virtue of asking, where is your outrage? Now I'm somehow seen as, oh, this guy is a corruption buster. He's going in hard. The thing is, I'm asking what we should be asking. And that if that makes you somehow a celebrity, it's very difficult then for the journalist.
You can't control it.
I can't control how I'm perceived. No, you can't.
I think it's a case of who guards the guardians, because at the end of the day, the buck kind of stops with journalists. I think society relies on you. It's why you have this title of the Fourth Estate. You are the unelected part of the world that controls a lot. And so when journalism is put up on a pedestal, and that's deserving in some respects, but when individuals amongst there get put up onto pedestals, the worry just becomes who's checking them? Are they checking themselves? And to me, it sounds like, for example, you check yourself. So you go, hold on a second, like, this is who I am and this is what I do, and I'm not bigger than the thing. But celebrity's fun, and it's nice, and it's cool to have people saying cool things about you, and it's even sometimes cool to have people who didn't know who the hell you were saying bad things about you. People like that. They like to have that. Mm. The model for this is Donald Trump. I mean, he doesn't care whether it's good or bad. He loves it all. Mm. And so it's just about checking yourself, really, and I suppose it comes down to the individual.
Yeah, it does. Look, don't kid yourself. There are people that journalism is not an easy world to operate in. Investigative journalism, even less so. There are some very real consequences that we suffer as a result of the work that we do, whether it is people drawing nasty cartoons of you.
I think poverty is the. I'm not even using that flippantly. I think one of the major problems we have is that journalists aren't paid enough. And obviously it's a market model, and the way the market's currently structured, there isn't just enough money for the job that's being done often, which is why, you know, everyone's now moving towards this pay for value model. The what we have is a Patreon model. What Daily Maverick now has is a sort of a premium subscriber model. You know, ENCA will obviously earn money from the DSTV side of things, from ads and things like that. So they're still okay. But, you know, the Mail and Guardian is, I would imagine, likely to die unless its funders keep it in business. It's 30,000 readers, I think. And how many advertisers really want to target 30,000 people? Especially when through social media, you can target hundreds of thousands much more easily. So there's a big problem in this, and as you start paying people less, you know, pay peanuts, get monkeys. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to use that word, but I'm referring to Mike. So there's a very real problem in that. I don't know, maybe you want to talk a bit about the future of journalism and where we're going.
It's a term that's thrown around a lot. I don't particularly like the term juniorization of the newsroom, but it should scare you.
I think it's deseniorization is the bigger problem.
Yeah, okay,
it's not,
all right.
They've always been junior reporters, right? Yeah. But the biggest problem is that there were senior subs and senior editors.
Yeah.
And we've seen in this country, we've had bloggers elevated to the position of editors of major newspapers. We've had relatively junior journalists who are clearly activists, not journalists, elevated to editorial positions. So I think it's the deseniorization.
Yeah. And is it self-inflicted in a way? Not at your company specifically, but as an industry generally.
Look, I think the media landscape industry, it's suffering. I think people that have made careers out of being sub-editors or a specific niche within a newsroom that's critical to the quality of the product coming out at the other end, I think there are loopholes forming where people in all facets of the industry are going, is this person really necessary? Can we do without them? There's mass retrenchments in many companies. And I think it's starting to show, and an indictment to the fact that my title is not senior journalist, but amongst the pool of journalists that I work with in my newsroom, I would be one of the most senior. And that's frightening to me because I've only been doing this job since 2005. What's that?
13 years.
13 years.
That's a lot.
The thing is, where is my role model? Where is the person I need to bounce ideas off that is on the ground, that is a journalist that I can look up to? I think that is disappearing a lot.
And the frustration, Michael, is that you go to Brazil, you go to Venezuela, lots of time traveling, which I hate. I hope you hate too, in transit. You do these stories and you come back and it appears, with due respect, no one gives a shit. Like, no one cares about what you do.
Yeah, well, you can't fight the numbers. So when viewership tells you that a massive look at emerging markets, policy direction, the economy, policy, the electorate, when the numbers tell you that people just did not respond to it, it's not an indictment of the quality of the product. It is, I say with respect, South Africa, an indictment of South Africans.
Yeah, the movie industry would be a good...
I just wish to rebut that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, though? Because the click-based revenue model has been around since 2008, I would suspect, somewhere around there.
2010, 2011.
Right, and Gawker was the first, and then BuzzFeed started, 10 things, you know, white people do that black people hate, et cetera, et cetera. Those things get millions of clicks. I would argue it's the short dopamine rush from clickbait, from the medium themselves to make more money, has colored the good stuff. The good stuff that takes a long time to prepare, a long time to digest, a long time to make, that's not appealing anymore. Because I want, you know, a top 10 list of 10 reasons why Zim is an arsehole.
Okay, well, can I just point out before you answer is that Heat magazine out of business. Why? Because mainstream publications now do what Heat does.
Yeah, FHM, out.
Gone, because that now gets done by the mainstream. So the sort of, what were they called? Those
lifestyle magazines.
No. Whatever they were, those
celebrity gossip.
Scandal sort of papers are actually part of the mainstream now.
Tabloids.
Tabloids, that's it.
Yeah. Do you know how rare it is? And I have to check myself sometimes as well, where an article will come up, I will scroll down and I'll look at the little bar on the right to see how long is this thing. Generally, how short is our attention spans these days as human beings? If we're not tied to our cell phones for a quick, I want to scroll twice with my thumb and then I want to be at the end of the article. So it is a consequence of what we have become, that long, in-depth news articles, feature stories where the actual truth and what is most important about the story may be at the end. People are not going to get there. And I accept that that is what we have become. So for a South African standing on the Venezuelan border to be speaking about corruption, socialism, their gas and oil reserves, and at the end to go, 2 million people have fled this country. That's the most important. Put policy, put everything aside. For those people, what's real is they've felt the need to get the hell out of Dodge. That is the most important piece there, that people cannot live in their own country. And sometimes you need to reevaluate how you structure your stories so that people don't just, cross, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
It happens.
It's news as entertainment is the problem.
An ironic thing, someone like Joe Rogan, okay, we do podcasts, so we talk about podcasts a lot. So you must excuse us. We do, not fellate over these things, but we do like it a lot.
Yeah, it's fine. You can describe yourself like that.
I don't. Except when Jordan Peterson's on Joe Rogan. Then 3 hours is great. But that's the point. Someone like Sam Harris or Jordan Peterson or I heard a guy who trains mixed martial artists. 3 hour podcast. I listened to it last week. Jake the Snake, WWE wrestler. 3 hour
Jake
podcast.
The Snake was great, man.
The amount of things that I have learned through people conversing, and it goes anywhere from politics to injuries to nutrition to ideas about the world to chemtrails to whatever it is, the amount of stuff you can fit into an hour, 2 hour, 3 hour audio podcast is absolutely immense. So it's weird that our attention for audio is longer than ever. But our attention for text is shorter than ever.
Yeah,
I don't know how to explain that, and I don't have a theory about it. But I'm just pointing out that your 5 minute piece on ENCA in the sewage thing, I think it's good to share. It's short enough that people it'll grab their attention, and hopefully they'll see it. But if you have a podcast like this, which will be listened to hopefully by thousands and thousands of people, you're able to do everything that you do throughout the year in an hour and a half. Isn't that a bit weird?
Yeah, it is. And the thing is, what I've started to do lately is pick up books. Like, just try to pick up a book. I'm reading How to Steal a Country at the moment.
Good book.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to focus my mind. Get the ability, the stuff I had back in school and varsity, the ability to read page after page after page and get lost in a book without reaching for a damn cell phone. And we need to get that ability back. And what the result of such a short attention span is, as journalists, you find I need to get – so at ENCA, it's not a secret. We try to keep stories to 1 minute 30. Where you need to be able to fit everything into that. It's very difficult, very difficult. The skill is not what you put in, it's what you leave out. That becomes important. But you'll find that you're feeling the need to find the most horrific visuals that's going to capture and keep somebody's attention. Where sometimes the most important thing being said is just somebody standing in front of a microphone. And it's not a horrific visual, but just get people to listen to what they're saying. That ability to take in information and let it stay there. I don't know if we have that ability anymore. It's rare. We now have to shock and awe tactic to get somebody to really notice something.
Yeah, everything is moving this way. Ramon's right. There's even services now which take great books and distill them down into 15-minute audio
that
podcasts.
Is the end of civilization.
And you know, you take Solzhenitsyn and you distill him down into 15 minutes and you're going, no, like I'm sure you can kind of say what the book generally says. But there's a major sort of problem with that. We've seen it in visual as well. Television's become more popular than film, than movies, and yes, people binge, but at the end of the day, it's 40 minutes at a time, and you can stop at any time, and you don't lose yourself at all. The shortening attention span, you're probably right, is kind of tending towards the end of civilization.
No, just reducing the Gulag archipelago to 15 minutes. Like, that's the end of civilization. That is really it. So, I mean, Michael, this has been illuminating, but unfortunately, you know, the boss needs a studio, like he owns a place or something. So, unfortunately, we have to cut it fairly soon. But based on your travels to Venezuela, Brazil, two countries that are more similar than we think to South Africa, and two outcomes that are possible in this place. And I go back to my previous question. I don't know if you answered in a way that I like, because the show is about me, Michael. Yeah. Well, and Jonathan too, but it's about me predominantly. It strokes my ego. We are headed to a path that is very Venezuelan, And we sort of need a Brazil, a Bolsonaro. Not, we don't need him, but it would be very nice to have someone like that with all the warts and all. What can, I mean, if there is any lesson to be gained from those two countries for South Africa, is there one that you can condense in 30 seconds? Because we have a shorter attention spans.
Sometimes be careful what you wish for as a population, as society. At the end of the day, we give so much responsibility to those that we elect in to basically control us at the end of the day. So be very careful who you put in those positions. I think South Africa is a mess at the moment. I think we have so much political infighting in the governing ruling party, ANC, at the moment. We have a president that for a very long time was treated with kid gloves by the media because he was seen as somebody who never stood right next to Jacob Zuma or wasn't in his executive at a time when the country was being looted on a wholesale level. And I think we have to ask tougher questions of those that we put into power, whether we like them or not, and be careful what you wish for. There are consequences.
Yeah, I think I agree. But I think a good heuristic is that whatever power you wish to give to those that you like, give that to your enemy. Give the same power to your enemy and see the consequences of that. So ultimately, the point is, don't give power away, especially to politicians.
Yeah, well,
that's probably another hour discussion on the way the government in this country is set up. And I suppose it feeds right back to, you know, standing next to a pile of garbage. And the reality is councillors don't really, never mind councillors, but representatives in parliament certainly aren't responsible to their voters.
Yeah.
They're responsible to their party. And that's definitely one of the circumventing power issues we have.
Yeah, well, as long as there's more anarchy and more secession, I'm happy.
There's this push for anarchy. We had to have one every show.
The more chaos, the better, because people will take control of their lives sooner or later just through sheer necessity. So, Michael, do you want to be known on... I mean, you are on Twitter. I mean, do you want to punt anything that you do?
After we gave him such a hard time, bloody well, give him a Twitter punt, for God's sake.
No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm happiest when people in power don't know where I am in the country. And it sounds strange, but it's become a hazard. I don't think things are going as well as they should be. And the job that we do, the public needs to know that there's a lot of risk that we take on ourselves for the utopian greater good. And I don't think I expect people to want to take selfies with me, and no, just watch and just listen to what's coming your way.
100%. Thank you so much.
Be more active citizens. We keep selling this to people. Let's do it.
Mark Apple on ENCA. I'm sure you can see him pretty much all the time on there. Love to have some of your colleagues on the show as well, so please punt that. If you enjoyed the show, you can always support us on Patreon. Any donations are welcome. That's how we keep the show going and develop the show. We're also on Twitter @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, the page and the group. Feel free to join. As always, thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.